between two other roses which remained on the branch. I returned home then, my mind greatly disturbed, for I am certain now, as certain as I am of the alternation of day and night, that there exists close to me an invisible being that lives on milk and water, that can touch objects, take them and change their places, that is consequently endowed with a material nature, although it is imperceptible to our senses, and that lives, as I do, under my roof. August 7th. I slept tranquilly. He drank the water out of my decanter, but did not disturb my sleep. I wonder if I am mad. As I was walking just now in the sun by the riverside, doubts as to my sanity arose in me. Not vague doubts such as I have had hitherto, but definite, absolute doubts. I have seen mad people, and I have known some who have been quite intelligent, lucid, even clear-sighted in every concern of life, except on one point. They spoke readily, clearly, profoundly on everything, when suddenly their mind struck upon the shoals of their madness and broke to pieces there and scattered and floundered in that furious and terrible sea, full of rolling waves, fogs, and squalls, which is called madness. I certainly should think that I was mad, absolutely mad, if I were not conscious, did not perfectly know my condition, did not fathom it by analyzing it with the most complete lucidity. I should, in fact, be only a rational man who was laboring under an hallucination. Some unknown disturbance must have arisen in my brain, one of those disturbances which physiologists of the present day try to note and to verify, and that disturbance must have caused a deep gap in my mind and in the sequence and logic of my ideas. Similar phenomena occur in dreams which lead us among the most unlikely phantasmagoria, without causing us any surprise, because our verifying apparatus and our organ of control are asleep, while our imaginative faculty is awake and active. Is it not possible that one of the imperceptible notes of the cerebral keyboard had been paralyzed in me? Some men lose the recollection of proper names, of verbs, or of numbers, or merely of dates, in consequence of an accident. The localization of all the variations of thought has been established nowadays. Why, then, should it be surprising if my faculty of controlling the unreality of certain hallucinations were dormant in me for the time being? I thought of all this as I walked by the side of the water. The sun shone brightly on the river and made earth delightful, while it filled me with a love for life, for the swallows, whose agility always delights my eye, for the plants by the riverside, the rustle of whose leaves is a pleasure to my ears. By degrees, however, an inexplicable feeling of discomfort seized me. It seemed as if some unknown force were numbing and stopping me, were preventing me from going further and were calling me back. I felt that painful wish to return which oppresses you when you have left a beloved invalid at home, and when you are seized with a presentiment that he is worse. I, therefore, returned in spite of myself, feeling certain that I should find some bad news awaiting me, a letter or a telegram. There was nothing, however, and I was more surprised and uneasy than if I had had another fantastic vision. August 8th. I spent a terrible evening yesterday. He does not show himself any more, but I feel that he is near me, watching me, looking at me, penetrating me, dominating me, and more redoubtable when he hides himself thus than if he were to manifest his constant and invisible presence by supernatural phenomena. However, I slept. August 9th. Nothing, but I'm afraid. August 10th. Nothing. What will happen tomorrow? August 11th. Still nothing. I cannot stop at home with this fear hanging over me and these thoughts in my mind. I shall go away. August 12th. 10 o'clock at night. All day long I have been trying to get away and have not been able. I wish to accomplish this simple and easy act of freedom, to go out, to get into my carriage in order to go to Rouen, and I have not been able to do it. What is the reason? August 13th. When one is attacked by certain maladies, All the springs of our physical being appear to be broken, all our energies destroyed, all our muscles relaxed, our bones, too, have become as soft as flesh, and our blood as liquid as water. I am experiencing these sensations in my moral being in a strange and distressing manner. I have no longer any strength, any courage, any self-control, not even any power to set my own will in motion. I have no power left to will anything, but someone does it for me, and I obey. August 14th. I am lost. Somebody possesses my soul and dominates it. Somebody orders all my acts, all my movements, all my thoughts. I am no longer anything in myself. Nothing except an enslaved and terrified spectator of all the things I do. I wish to go out. I cannot. He does not wish to, and so I remain, trembling and distracted, in the armchair in which he keeps me sitting. I merely wish to get up and to rouse myself so as to think that I am master of myself. I cannot. I am riveted to my chair, and my chair adheres to the ground in such a manner that no power could move us. Then, suddenly, I must go to the bottom of my garden to pick some strawberries and eat them, and I go there. I pick the strawberries and eat them. Oh, my God, my God, is there a God? If there be one, deliver me, save me, succor me, pardon, pity, mercy, save me. Oh, what sufferings, what torture, what horror! August 15th. This is certainly the way in which my poor cousin was possessed and controlled when she came to borrow 5,000 francs of me. She was under the power of a strange will which had entered into her, like another soul, like another parasitic and dominating soul. Is the world coming to an end? But who is he, this invisible being that rules me, this unknowable being, this rover of a supernatural race? Invisible beings exist, then. How is it, then, that since the beginning of the world they have never manifested themselves precisely as they do to me? I have never read of anything that resembles what goes on in my house. Oh, if I could only leave it, if I could only go away, escape, and never return, I should be saved. But I cannot. August 16th. I managed to escape today for 2 hours, like a prisoner who finds the door of his dungeon accidentally open. I suddenly felt that I was free and that he was far away, and so I gave orders to harness the horses as quickly as possible, and I drove to Rouen. Oh, how delightful to be able to say to a man who obeys you, "Go to Rouen!" I made him pull up before the library, and I begged them to lend me Dr. Hermann Herestauss's treatise on the unknown inhabitants of the ancient and modern world. Then, as I was getting into my carriage, I intended to say, "To the railway station!" But instead of this, I shouted in such a loud voice that all the passers-by turned round, "Home!" And I fell back on the cushion of my carriage, overcome by mental agony. He had found me again and regained possession of me. August 17th. Oh, what a night! What a night! And yet it seems to me that I ought to rejoice. I read until 1 o'clock in the morning. Herestauss, doctor of philosophy and theogony, wrote the history of the manifestation of all those invisible beings which hover round man, or of whom he dreams. He describes their origin, their domain, their power, but none of them resembles the one which haunts me. One might say that man, ever since he began to think, has had a foreboding fear of a new being, stronger than himself, his successor in this new world, and that, feeling his presence and not being able to foresee the nature of that master, he has, in his terror, created the whole race of occult beings, of vague phantoms born of fear. Having therefore read until 1 o'clock in the morning, I went and sat down at the open window in order to cool my forehead and my thoughts in the calm night air. It was very pleasant and warm. How I should have enjoyed such a night formerly! There was no moon, but the stars darted out their rays in the dark heavens. Who inhabits those worlds? What forms, what living beings, what animals are there yonder? What can they do more than we can? What do they see which we do not know? Will not one of them, some day or other, traversing space, appear on our earth to conquer it, just as the Norsemen formerly crossed the sea in order to subjugate nations more feeble than themselves? We are so weak, so defenseless, so ignorant, so small, we who live on this particle of mud which revolves in a drop of water. I fell asleep, dreaming thus in the cool night air, and when I had slept for about 3/4 of an hour, I opened my eyes without moving, awakened by I know not what confused and strange sensation. At first I saw nothing, and then suddenly it appeared to me as if a page of a book which had remained open on my table turned over of its own accord. Not a breath of air had come in at my window, and I was surprised and waited. In about 4 minutes I saw with my own eyes, another page lift itself up and fall down on the others, as if a finger had turned it over. My armchair was empty, appeared empty, but I knew that he was there, he, and sitting in my place, and that he was reading. With a furious bound, the bound of an enraged wild beast that springs at its tamer, I crossed my room to seize him, to strangle him, to kill him. But before I could reach it, the chair fell over as if somebody had run away from me. My table rocked, my lamp fell and went out, and my window closed as if some thief had been surprised and had fled out into the night, shutting it behind him. So he had run away. He had been afraid. He, afraid of me. But, tomorrow or later, some day or other, I should be able to hold him in my clutches and crush him against the ground. Do not dogs occasionally bite and strangle their masters? August 18th. I have been thinking the whole day long. Oh yes, I will obey him, follow his impulses, fulfill all his wishes, show myself humble, submissive, a coward. He is the stronger, but the hour will come. August 19th. I know all. I have just read the following in the Revue du Monde Scientifique. A curious piece of news comes to us from Rio de Janeiro. Madness, an epidemic of madness which may be compared to that contagious madness which attacked the people of Europe in the Middle Ages, is at this moment raging in the province of San Paolo. The terrified inhabitants are leaving their houses, saying that they are pursued, possessed, dominated like human cattle by invisible, though tangible beings, a species of vampire, which feed on their life while they are asleep, and who, besides, drink water and milk without appearing to touch any other nourishment. Professor Don Pedro Henriquez, accompanied by several medical savants, has gone to the province of San Paolo in order to study the origin and the manifestations of this surprising madness on the spot, and to propose such measures to the emperor as may appear to him to be most fitted to restore the mad population to reason. Ah, I remember now that fine Brazilian three-master which passed in front of my windows as it was going up the Seine, on the 8th day of last May. I thought it looked so pretty, so white and bright. That being was on board of her, coming from there where its race originated. And it saw me. It saw my house, which was also white, and it sprang from the ship onto the land. Oh, merciful heaven! Now I know I can divine. The reign of man is over, and he has come. He who was feared by primitive man, whom disquieted priests exorcised, whom sorcerers evoked on dark nights without having seen him appear, to whom the imagination of the transient masters of the world lent all the monstrous or graceful forms of gnomes, spirits, genii, fairies, and familiar spirits. After the coarse conceptions of primitive fear, more clear-sighted men foresaw it more clearly. Mesmer divined him, and 10 years ago physicians accurately discovered the nature of his power, even before he exercised it himself. They played with this new weapon of the Lord, the sway of a mysterious will over the human soul, which had become a slave. They called it magnetism, hypnotism, suggestion. What do I know? I have seen them amusing themselves like rash children with this horrible power. Woe to us! Woe to man! He has come, what does he call himself? I fancy that he is shouting out his name to me, and I do not hear him. Yes, he is shouting it out. I am listening. I cannot. He repeats it. The Orla. I hear. The Orla. It is he. The Orla. He has come. Ah, the vulture has eaten the pigeon. The wolf has eaten the lamb. The lion has devoured the sharp-horned buffalo. Man has killed the lion with an arrow, with sword, with gunpowder. But the Orla will make of man what we have made of the horse and of the ox. His chattel, his slave, and his food by the mere power of his will. Woe to us! But nevertheless, the animal sometimes revolts and kills the man who has subjugated it. I shall be able to, but I must know him, touch him, see him. Scientists say that animals' eyes, being different from ours, do not distinguish objects as ours do, and my eye cannot distinguish this newcomer who is oppressing me. Why? Oh, now I remember the words of the monk at Mont Saint-Michel. Can we see the 100,000 part of what exists? See here, there is the wind, which is the strongest force in nature, which knocks men and blows down buildings, uproots trees, raises the sea into mountains of water, destroys cliffs and casts great ships on the breakers. The wind which kills, which whistles, which sighs, which roars. Have you ever seen it? Can you see it? It exists for all that, however. And I went on thinking, my eyes are so weak, so imperfect, that they do not even distinguish hard bodies. If they are as transparent as glass, if a glass without tin foil behind it were to bar my way, I should run into it, just as a bird which has flown into a room breaks its head against the window panes. 1,000 things, moreover, deceive man and lead him astray. Why should it then be surprising that he cannot perceive an unknown body through which the light passes? A new being? Why not? It was assuredly bound to come. Why should we be the last? We do not distinguish it any more than all the others created before us. The reason is that its nature is more perfect, its body finer and more finished than ours, that ours is so weak, so awkwardly constructed, encumbered with organs that are always tired, always on the strain like machinery that is too complicated, which lives like a plant and like a beast, nourishing itself on air, herbs, and flesh, an animal machine which is a prey to maladies, to malformations, to decay, broken-winded, badly regulated, simple and eccentric, ingeniously badly made, at once a coarse and a delicate piece of workmanship, the rough sketch of a being that might become intelligent and grand. We are only a few, so few in this world, from the oyster up to the man. Why should there not be one more? Once that period is past which separates the successive apparitions from all the different species, why not one more? Why not also other trees with immense, splendid flowers perfuming whole regions? Why not other elements besides fire, air, earth, and water? There are four, only four, those nursing fathers of various beings. What a pity! Why are there not 40, 400, 4,000? How poor everything is, how mean and wretched. Grudgingly produced, roughly constructed, clumsily made. Ah, the elephant and the hippopotamus, what grace! And the camel, what elegance! But the butterfly, you will say, a flying flower, a dream of one that should be as large as 100 worlds, with wings whose shape, beauty, colors, and motion I cannot even express. But I see it. It flutters from star to star, refreshing them and perfuming them with the light and harmonious breath of its flight. And the people up there look at it as it passes in an ecstasy of delight. What is the matter with me? It is he, the Orla, who haunts me, and who makes me think of these foolish things. He is within me. He is becoming my soul. I shall kill him. August 19th. I shall kill him. I have seen him. Yesterday I sat down at my table and pretended to write very assiduously. I knew quite well that he would come prowling round me, quite close to me, so close that I might perhaps be able to touch him, to seize him. And then I should have the strength of desperation. I should have my hands, my knees, my chest, my forehead, my teeth to strangle him, to crush him, to bite him, to tear him to pieces. And I watched for him with all my overexcited senses. I had lighted my two lamps and the 8 wax candles on my mantelpiece, as if with this light I could discover him. My bedstead, my old oak post bedstead, stood opposite to me. On my right was the fireplace, on my left the door, which was carefully closed, after I had left it open for some time in order to attract him. Behind me was a very high wardrobe with a looking-glass in it, before which I stood to shave and dress every day, and in which I was in the habit of glancing at myself from head to foot every time I passed it. I pretended to be writing in order to deceive him, for he also was watching me, and suddenly I was certain that he was reading over my shoulder, that he was there touching my ear. I got up, my hands extended, and turned round so quickly that I almost fell. Eh? Well? It was as bright as at midday, but I did not see my reflection in the mirror. It was empty, clear, profound, full of light, but my figure was not reflected in it, and I was opposite to it. I saw the large, clear glass from top to bottom, and I looked at it with unsteady eyes, and I did not dare to advance. I did not venture to make a movement, feeling that he was there, but that he would escape me again, he whose imperceptible body had absorbed my reflection. How frightened I was! And then, suddenly, I began to see myself in a mist in the depths of the looking-glass, in a mist as if it were a sheet of water, and it seemed to me as if this water were flowing clearer every moment. It was like the end of an eclipse. Whatever it was that hid me did not appear to possess any clearly defined outlines, but a sort of opaque transparency which gradually grew clearer. At last I was able to distinguish myself completely, as I do every day when I look at myself. I had seen it, and the horror of it remained with me and makes me shudder even now. August 20th. How could I kill it, as I could not get hold of it? Poison? But it would see me mix it with the water, and then would our poisons have any effect on its impalpable body? No doubt about the matter. Then? August 21st. I sent for a blacksmith from Rouen, and ordered iron shutters for my room, such as some private hotels in Paris have on the ground floor, for fear of burglars, and he is going to make me an iron door as well. I have made myself out a coward, but I do not care about that. September 10th. Rouen. Hotel Continental. It is done. It is done, but is he dead? My mind is thoroughly upset by what I have seen. Well then, yesterday the locksmith, having put on the iron shutters and door, I left everything until midnight, although it was getting cold. Suddenly I felt that he was there, and joy, mad joy, took possession of me. I got up softly, and walked up and down for some time, so that he might not suspect anything. Then I took off my boots, and put on my slippers carelessly. Then I fastened the iron shutters, and going back to the door, quickly double-locked it with a padlock, putting the key into my pocket. Suddenly I noticed that he was moving restlessly round me, that in his turn he was frightened, and was ordering me to let him out. I nearly yielded. I did not, however, but putting my back to the door, I half opened it, just enough to allow me to go out backward. And as I am very tall, my head touched the casing. I was sure that he had not been able to escape, and I shut him up alone, quite alone. What happiness! I had him fast. Then I ran downstairs in the drawing room, which was under my bedroom. I took the 2 lamps and poured all the oil on the carpet, the furniture, everywhere. Then I set fire to it and made my escape, after having carefully double-locked the door. I went and hid myself at the bottom of the garden, in a clump of laurel bushes. How long it seemed! How long it seemed! Everything was dark, silent, motionless, not a breath of air, not a star, but heavy banks of clouds which one could not see, but which weighed, oh, so heavily on my soul. I looked at my house and waited. How long it was! I already began to think that the fire had gone out of its own accord, or that he had extinguished it, when one of the lower windows gave way under the violence of the flames, and a long, soft, caressing sheet of red flame mounted up the white wall and enveloped it as far as the roof. The light fell on the trees, the branches, and the leaves, and a shiver of fear pervaded them also. The birds awoke, a dog began to howl, and it seemed to me as if the day were breaking. Almost immediately, two other windows flew into fragments, and I saw that the whole of the lower part of my house was nothing but a terrible furnace. But a cry, a horrible, shrill, heart-rending cry. A woman's cry sounded through the night, and two garret windows were opened. I had forgotten the servants. I saw their terror-stricken faces and their arms waving frantically. Then, overwhelmed with horror, I set off to run to the village, shouting, "Help! Help! Fire! Fire!" I met some people who were already coming to the scene, and I returned with them. By this time, the house was nothing but a horrible and magnificent funeral pile, a monstrous funeral pile which lit up the whole country, a funeral pile where men were burning and where he was burning also. He, my prisoner, that new being, the new master, the Orla. Suddenly the whole roof fell in between the walls, and a volcano of flames darted up to the sky. Through all the windows which opened on that furnace, I saw the flames darting, and I thought he was there, in that kiln, dead. Dead? Perhaps. His body? Was not his body, which was transparent, indestructible by such means as would kill ours? If he were not dead? Perhaps time alone has power over that invisible and redoubtable being. Why this transparent, unrecognizable body, this body belonging to a spirit, if it also has to fear ills, infirmities, and premature destruction? Premature destruction. All human terror springs from that. After man, the Orla, after him who can die every day, at any hour, at any moment, by any accident, came the one who would die only at his own proper hour, day and minute, because he had touched the limits of his existence. No, no, without any doubt, he is not dead. Then, I suppose I must kill myself.
The Girl with the Hungry Eyes by Fritz Leiber. Fritz Reuter Leiber, 1910 to 1992, was born in Chicago, the son of two famous Shakespearean actors, Fritz Sr. and Virginia, née Bronson. He graduated from the University of Chicago with a degree in biology and briefly followed in his parents' footsteps as a thespian, appearing in several films, including the 1937 classic Camille with Greta Garbo and Robert Taylor, and The Hunchback of Notre Dame, 1939, in which his father also appeared. Leiber also studied at the General Theological Seminary in New York City. After World War II, he became an associate editor at Science Digest magazine, which inspired him to write science fiction and fantasy. His prolific career included the Sword and Sorcery, a term he created, series about Fawford, a hero based on himself, and The Grey Mouser, based on his friend Harry Otto Fisher, which spanned 50 years. Among his works to have been made into feature films, perhaps the best known is Conjure Wife, 1943, filmed three times, most famously as Burn Witch Burn, 1962, with a screenplay by George Baxt, Charles Beaumont, and Richard Matheson. It was also filmed as Weird Woman, 1944, and Witch's Brew, 1980. Leiber won 8 Hugo Awards and 2 Nebulas. The Girl with the Hungry Eyes was originally published in The Girl with the Hungry Eyes and Other Stories, edited by Donald Walheim, New York, Avon, 1949. It was filmed in 1995. John Jacobs directed.
The Girl with the Hungry Eyes by Fritz Leiber. Read by Eric Davies. All right. I'll tell you why the girl gives me the creeps. Why I can't stand to go downtown and see the mob slavering up at her on the tower with that pop bottle or pack of cigarettes or whatever it is beside her. Why I hate to look at magazines anymore because I know she'll turn up somewhere in a brassiere or a bubble bath. Why I don't like to think of millions of Americans drinking in that poisonous half-smile. It's quite a story. More story than you're expecting. No, I haven't suddenly developed any long-haired indignation at the evils of advertising and the national glamour girl complex. That'd be a laugh for a man in my racket, wouldn't it? Though I think you'll agree there's something a little perverted about trying to capitalize on sex that way. But it's okay with me. And I know we've had the face and the body and the look and whatnot else, so why shouldn't someone come along who sums it all up so completely that we have to call her the girl and blazon her on all the billboards from Times Square to Telegraph Hill? But the girl isn't like any of the others. She's unnatural. She's morbid. She's unholy. Oh, it's 1948, is it? And the sort of thing I'm hinting at went out with witchcraft? But you see, I'm not altogether sure myself what I'm hinting at, beyond a certain point. There are vampires and vampires, and not all of them suck blood. And there were the murders, if they were murders. Besides, let me ask you this. Why, when America is obsessed with the girl, don't we find out more about her? Why doesn't she rate a Time cover with a droll biography inside? Why hasn't there been a feature in Life or The Post, a profile in The New Yorker? Why hasn't Charm or Mademoiselle done her career saga? Not ready for it? Nuts. Why haven't the movies snapped her up? Why hasn't she been on Information, Please? Why don't we see her kissing candidates at political rallies? Why isn't she chosen queen of some sort of junk or other at a convention? Why don't we read about her tastes and hobbies, her views of the Russian situation? Why haven't the columnists interviewed her in a kimono on the top floor of the tallest hotel in Manhattan and told us who her boyfriends are? Finally, and this is the real killer, why hasn't she ever been drawn or painted? Oh, no, she hasn't. If you knew anything about commercial art, you'd know that. Every blessed one of those pictures was worked up from a photograph. Expertly? Of course. They've got the top artists on it. But that's how it's done. And now I'll tell you the why of all that. It's because from the top to the bottom of the whole world of advertising, news, and business, there isn't a solitary soul who knows where the girl came from, where she lives, what she does, who she is, even what her name is. You heard me. What's more, not a single solitary soul ever sees her, except one poor damned photographer who's making more money off her than he ever hoped to in his life, and who's scared and miserable as hell every minute of the day. No, I haven't the faintest idea who he is or where he has his studio, but I know there has to be such a man, and I'm morally certain he feels just like I said. Yes, I might be able to find her if I tried. I'm not sure, though. By now, she probably has other safeguards. Besides, I don't want to. Oh, I'm off my rocker, am I? That sort of thing can't happen in this year of our Adam, 1948. People can't keep out of sight that way. Not even Garbo. Well, I happen to know they can, because last year I was that poor damned photographer I was telling you about. Yes. Last year, in 1947, when the girl made her first poisonous splash right here in this big little city of ours. Yes, I knew you weren't here last year, and you don't know about it. Even the girl had to start small. But if you hunted through the files of the local newspapers, you'd find some ads, and I might be able to locate you some of the old displays. I think Lovely Belt is still using one of them. I used to have a mountain of photos myself, until I burned them. Yes, I made my cut off her. Nothing like what that other photographer must be making, but enough so it still bought this whiskey. She was funny about money. I'll tell you about that. But first, picture me in 1947. I had a fourth floor studio in that rat hole, the Hauser Building, catty corner from Ardley Park. I'd been working at the Marsh Mason Studios until I'd got my belly full of it and decided to start in for myself. The Hauser Building was crummy. I'll never forget how the stairs creaked. But it was cheap, and there was a skylight. Business was lousy. I kept making the rounds of all the advertisers and agencies, and some of them didn't object to me too much personally, but my stuff never clicked. I was pretty near broke. I was behind on my rent. Hell, I didn't even have enough money to have a girl. It was one of those dark gray afternoons. The building was awfully quiet. Even with the storage, they can't half-rent the Hauser. I'd just finished developing some pics I was doing on speculation for Lovely Belt Girdles and Buford's Pool and Playground, the last a faked-up beach scene. My model had left, Miss Leon. She was a civics teacher at one of the high schools and modeled for me on the side, just lately on speculation, too. After one look at the prints, I decided that Miss Leon probably wasn't just what Lovely Belt was looking for, or my photography either. I was about to call it a day. And then the street door slammed four stories down, and there were steps on the stairs, and she came in. She was wearing a cheap, shiny black dress, black pumps, no stockings, and except that she had a gray cloth coat over one of them, those skinny arms of hers were bare. Her arms are pretty skinny, you know. Or can you see things like that anymore? And then the thin neck, the slightly gaunt, almost prim face, the tumbling mass of dark hair, and looking out from under it, the hungriest eyes in the world. That's the real reason she's plastered all over the country today, you know. Those eyes. Nothing vulgar, but just the same, they're looking at you with a hunger that's all sex, and something more than sex. That's what everybody's been looking for since the year one. Something a little more than sex. Well, boys, there I was, along with the girl, in an office that was getting shadowy in a nearly empty building. A situation that a million male Americans have undoubtedly pictured to themselves with various lush details. How was I feeling? Scared. I know sex can be frightening, that cold, heart-thumping when you're alone with a girl and feel you're going to touch her. But if it was sex this time, it was overlaid with something else. At least, I wasn't thinking about sex. I remember that I took a backward step and that my hand jerked so that the photos I was looking at sailed to the floor. There was the faintest dizzy feeling, like something was being drawn out of me, just a little bit. That was all. Then she opened her mouth, and everything was back to normal for a while. "I see you're a photographer, mister," she said. "Could you use a model?" Her voice wasn't very cultivated. "I doubt it," I told her, picking up the pics. You see, I wasn't impressed. The commercial possibilities of her eyes hadn't registered on me yet, by a long shot. "What have you done?" Well, she gave me a vague sort of story, and I began to check her knowledge of model agencies and studios and rates and whatnot, and pretty soon I said to her, "Look here, You never modeled for a photographer in your life. You just walked in here cold. Well, she admitted that was more or less so. All along through our talk, I got the idea she was feeling her way, like someone in a strange place. Not that she was uncertain of herself or of me, but just of the general situation. "And you think anyone can model?" I asked her pityingly.
"Sure," she said.
"Look," I said, "a photographer can waste a dozen negatives trying to get one halfway human photo of an average woman. How many do you think he'd have to waste before he got a real catchy, glamorous pic of her?"
"I think I could do it," she said.
Well, I should have kicked her out right then. Maybe I admired the cool way she stuck to her dumb little guns. Maybe I was touched by her underfed look. More likely, I was feeling mean on account of the way my pics had been snubbed by everybody, and I wanted to take it out on her by showing her up. "Okay, I'm gonna put you on the spot," I told her. "I'm gonna try a couple of shots of you. Understand, it's strictly on spec. If somebody should ever want to use a photo of you, which is about one chance in 2 million, I'll pay you regular rates for your time, not otherwise." She gave me a smile, the first.
"That's swell by me," she said.
Well, I took 3 or 4 shots, close-ups of her face, since I didn't fancy her cheap dress, and at least she stood up to my sarcasm. Then I remembered I still had the lovely belt stuff, and I guess the meanness was still working in me, because I handed her a girdle and told her to go behind the screen and get into it, and she did, without getting flustered as I'd expected. And since we'd gone that far, I figured we'd might as well shoot the beach scene to round it out, and that was that. All this time, I wasn't feeling anything particular in one way or the other, except every once in a while I'd get one of those faint dizzy flashes and wonder if there was something wrong with my stomach or if I could have been a bit careless with my chemicals. Still, you know, I think the uneasiness was in me all the while. I tossed her a card and pencil. "Write your name and address and phone," I told her, and made for the dark room. A little while later, she walked out. I didn't call any goodbyes. I was irked because she hadn't fussed around or seemed anxious about her poses, or even thanked me, except for that one smile. I finished developing the negatives, made some prints, glanced at them, decided they weren't a great deal worse than Miss Leon. On an impulse, I slipped them in with the pics I was going to take on the rounds next morning. By now, I'd worked long enough so I was a bit fagged and nervous, but I didn't dare waste enough money on liquor to help that. I wasn't very hungry. I think I went to a cheap movie. I didn't think of the girl at all, except maybe to wonder faintly why in my present womanless state I hadn't made a pass at her. She had seemed to belong to a, well, distinctly more approachable social stratum than Miss Leon. But then, of course, there were all sorts of arguable reasons for my not doing that. Next morning, I made the rounds. My first step was Munch's Brewery. They were looking for a Munch girl. Papa Munch had a sort of affection for me, though he razzed my photography. He had a good natural judgment about that, too. 50 years ago, he might have been one of the shoestring boys who made Hollywood. Right now, he was out in the plant pursuing his favorite occupation. He put down the beaded can, smacked his lips, gabbled something technical to someone about hops, wiped his fat hands on the big apron he was wearing, and grabbed my thin stack of picks. He was about halfway through, making noises with his tongue and teeth, when he came to her. I kicked myself for even having stuck her in.
"That's her," he said. "The photography's not so hot, but that's the girl."
It was all decided. I wondered now why Papa Munch sensed what the girl had right away, while I didn't. I think it was because I saw her first in the flesh, if that's the right word. At the time, I just felt faint.
"Who is she?"
he asked. "One of my new models." I tried to make it casual.
"Bring her out tomorrow morning," he told me. "And your stuff. We'll photograph her here. I want to show you. Here, don't look so sick," he added. "Have some beer."
Well, I went away telling myself it was just a fluke, so that she'd probably blow it tomorrow with her inexperience and so on. Just the same, when I reverently laid my next stack of pics on Mr. Fitch of Lovely Belt's rose-colored blotter, I had hers on top. Mr. Fitch went through the motions of being an art critic. He leaned over backward, squinted his eyes, waved his long fingers, and said,
"What do you think, Miss Willow? Here, in this light. Of course, the photograph doesn't show the bias cut, and perhaps we should use the Lovely Belt imp instead of the angel. Still, the girl... Come over here, Binns."
More finger-waving.
"I want a married man's reaction."
He couldn't hide the fact that he was hooked. Exactly the same thing happened at Buford's pool and playground, except that DaCosta didn't need a married man's say-so.
"Hot stuff,"
he said, sucking his lips.
"Oh boy, you photographers."
I hot-footed it back to the office and grabbed up the card I'd given her to put down her name and address. It was blank. I don't mind telling you that the next 5 minutes were about the worst I ever went through, in an ordinary way. When next morning rolled around and I still hadn't got hold of her, I had to start stalling. "She's sick," I told Papa Munch over the phone.
"She's at a hospital?"
he asked me.
"Nothing that serious," I told him.
"Get her out here, then. What's a little headache?"
"Sorry, I can't."
Papa Munch got suspicious.
"You really got this girl?"
"Of course I have."
"Well, I don't know. I'd think it was some New York model, except I recognized your lousy photography."
I laughed.
"Well, look, you get her here tomorrow morning, you hear?"
"I'll try."
"Try nothing. You get her out here."
He didn't know half of what I tried. I went around to all the model and employment agencies. I did some slick detective work at the photographic and art studios. I used up some of my last dimes putting advertisements in all three papers. I looked at high school yearbooks and at employee photos in local house organs. I went to restaurants and drugstores looking for waitresses, and to dime stores and department stores looking at clerks. I watched the crowds coming out of movie theaters. I roamed the streets. Evenings, I spent quite a bit of time along Pickup Row. Somehow, that seemed the right place. The fifth afternoon, I knew I was licked. Papa Munch's deadline, he'd given me several, but this was it, was due to run out at 6 o'clock. Mr. Fitch had already canceled. I was at the studio window, looking out at Ardley Park. She walked in. I'd gone over this moment so often in my mind that I had no trouble putting on my act. Even the faint dizzy feeling didn't throw me off.
"Hello,"
I said, hardly looking at her.
"Hello,"
she said.
"Not discouraged yet?"
"No."
It didn't sound uneasy or defiant. It was just a statement. I snapped a look at my watch and got up and said curtly,
"Look here, I'm going to give you a chance. There's a client of mine looking for a girl your general type. If you do a real good job, you may break into the modeling business." "We can see him this afternoon if we hurry," I said. I picked up my stuff. "Come on.
And next time, if you expect favors, don't forget to leave your phone number.
Uh-uh,
she said, not moving. What do you mean? I said.
I'm not going to see any client of yours.
The hell you aren't, I said.
You little nut, I'm giving you a break.
She shook her head slowly.
You're not fooling me, baby. You're not fooling me at all. They want me.
And she gave me the second smile. At the time, I thought she must have seen my newspaper ad. Now I'm not so sure.
And now I'll tell you how we're going to work.
She went on.
You aren't going to have my name or address or phone number. Nobody is. And we're going to do all the pictures right here. Just you and me.
You can imagine the roar I raised at that. I was everything. Angry, sarcastic, patiently explanatory, off my nut, threatening, pleading. I would have slapped her face off, except it was photographic capital. In the end, all I could do was phone Papa Munch and tell him her conditions. I knew I didn't have a chance, but I had to take it. He gave me a really angry bawling out and said no several times and hung up. It didn't faze her.
We'll start shooting at 10 o'clock tomorrow, she said.
It was just like her, using that corny line from the movie magazines. About midnight, Papa Munch called me up. I don't know what insane asylum you're renting this girl from, he said. But I'll take her. Come around tomorrow morning and I'll try to get it through your head just how I want the pictures. And I'm glad I got you out of bed. After that, it was a breeze. Even Mr. Fitch reconsidered, and after taking 2 days to tell me it was quite impossible, he accepted the conditions too. Of course, you're all under the spell of the girl, so you can't understand how much self-sacrifice it represented on Mr. Fitch's part when he agreed to forego supervising the photography of my model in the lovely belt Imp or Vixen or whatever it was we finally used. Next morning, she turned up on time, according to her schedule, and we went to work. I'll say one thing for her. She never got tired, and she never kicked at the way I fussed over shots. I got along okay, except I still had the feeling of something being shoved gently away. Maybe you felt it just a little, looking at her picture. When we finished, I found out there were still more rules. It was about the middle of the afternoon. I started down with her to get a sandwich and coffee.
Uh-uh, she said. I'm going down alone. And look, baby, if you ever try to follow me, if you ever so much as stick your head out that window when I go, you can hire yourself another model.
You can imagine how all this crazy stuff strained my temper and my imagination. I remember opening the window after she was gone. I waited a few minutes first. And standing there, getting some fresh air and trying to figure out what could be back of it, whether she was hiding from the police or was somebody's ruined daughter, or maybe had got the idea it was smart to be temperamental, or more likely, Papa Munch was right, and she was partly nuts. But I had my picks to finish up. Looking back, it's amazing to think how fast her magic began to take hold of the city after that. Remembering what came after, I'm frightened of what's happening to the whole country, and maybe the world. Yesterday, I read something in Time about the girl's picture turning up on billboards in Egypt. The rest of my story will help show you why I'm frightened in that big, general way. But I have a theory, too, that helps explain, though it's one of those things that's beyond that certain point. It's about the girl. I'll give it to you in a few words. You know how modern advertising gets everybody's mindset in the same direction
wanting the same things, imagining the same things, and you know the psychologists aren't so skeptical of telepathy as they used to be. Add up the two ideas. Suppose the identical desires of millions of people focused on one telepathic person, say a girl, shaped her in their image. Imagine her knowing the hiddenmost hungers of millions of men. Imagine her seeing deeper into those hungers than the people that had them, seeing the hatred and the wish for death behind the lust. Imagine her shaping herself in that complete image, keeping herself as aloof as marble. Yet imagine the hunger she might feel in answer to their hunger. But that's getting a long way from the facts of my story. And some of those facts are darn solid, like money. We made money. That was the funny thing I was going to tell you. I was afraid the girl was going to hold me up. She really had me over a barrel, you know. But she didn't ask for anything but the regular rates. Later on, I insisted on pushing more money at her, a whole lot. But she always took it with that same contemptuous look, as if she were going to toss it down the first drain when she got outside. Maybe she did. At any rate, I had money. For the first time in months, I had money enough to get drunk, buy new clothes, take taxicabs. I could make a play for any girl I wanted to. I only had to pick. And so, of course, I had to go and pick. But first, let me tell you about Papa Munch. Papa Munch wasn't the first of the boys to try to meet my model, but I think he was the first to really go soft on her. I could watch the change in his eyes as he looked at her pictures. They began to get sentimental, reverent. Mama Munch had been dead for 2 years. He was smart about the way he planned it. He got me to drop some information which told him when she came to work, and then one morning he came pounding up the stairs a few minutes before. "I've got to see her, Dave," he told me. I argued with him. I kidded him. I explained he didn't know just how serious she was about her crazy ideas. I pointed out he was cutting both our throats. I even amazed myself by bawling him out. He didn't take any of it in his usual way. He just kept repeating, "But Dave, I've got to see her." The street door slammed. "That's her," I said, lowering my voice. "You've got to get out." He wouldn't, so I shoved him in the dark room. "And keep quiet," I whispered. "I'll tell her I can't work today." I knew he'd try to look at her and probably come busting in, but there wasn't anything else I could do. The footsteps came to the fourth floor, but she never showed at the door. I got uneasy. "Get that bum out of there," she yelled suddenly from beyond the door. Not very loud, but in her commonest voice. "I'm going up to the next landing," she said. "And if that fat-bellied bum doesn't march straight down to the street, he'll never get another pick of me except spitting in his lousy beer." Papa Munch came out of the dark room. He was white. He didn't look at me as he went out. He never looked at her pictures in front of me again. That was Papa Munch. Now, it's me I'm telling about. I talked about the subject with her. I hinted. Eventually, I made my pass. She lifted my hand off her as if it were a damp rag.
"Nix, baby," she said. "This is working time."
"But afterward?" I pressed.
"The rules still hold."
And I got what I think was the fifth smile. It's hard to believe, but she never budged an inch from that crazy line. I mustn't make a pass at her in the office,
because our work was very important and she loved it, and there mustn't be any distractions. And I couldn't see her anywhere else, because if I tried to, I'd never snap another picture of her. And all this with more money coming in all the time, and me never so stupid as to think my photography had anything to do with it. Of course, I wouldn't have been human if I hadn't made more passes. But they always got the wet rag treatment, and there weren't any more smiles. I changed. I went sort of crazy and lightheaded, only sometimes I felt my head was going to burst. And I started to talk to her all the time about myself. It was like being in a constant delirium that never interfered with business. I didn't pay attention to the dizzy feeling. It seemed natural. I'd walk around, and for a moment the reflector would look like a sheet of white-hot steel, or the shadows would seem like armies of moths, or the camera would be a big black coal car. But the next instant, they'd come all right again. I think sometimes I was scared to death of her. She'd seem the strangest, horriblest person in the world. But other times, and I talked. It didn't matter what I was doing, lighting her, posing her, fussing with props, snapping my pics, or where she was, on the platform, behind the screen, relaxing with a magazine, I kept up a steady gab. I told her everything I knew about myself. I told her about my first girl. I told her about my brother Bob's bicycle. I told her about running away on a freight and the licking Pa gave me when I came home. I told her about shipping to South America and the blue sky at night. I told her about Betty. I told her about my mother dying of cancer. I told her about being beaten up in a fight in an alley behind a bar. I told her about Mildred. I told her about the first picture I ever sold. I told her how Chicago looked from a sailboat. I told her about the longest drunk I was ever on. I told her about Marsh Mason. I told her about Gwen. I told her about how I met Papa Munch. I told her about hunting her. I told her about how I felt now. She never paid the slightest attention to what I said. I couldn't even tell if she heard me. It was when we were getting our first nibble from national advertisers that I decided to follow her when she went home. Wait, I can place it better than that. Something you'll remember from the out-of-town papers, those maybe murders I mentioned. I think there were six. I say maybe because the police could never be sure they weren't heart attacks. But there's bound to be suspicion when heart attacks happen to people whose hearts have been okay, and always at night when they're alone and away from home, and there's a question of what they were doing. The six deaths created one of those mystery poisoner scares, and afterward there was a feeling that they hadn't really stopped, but were being continued in a less suspicious way. That's one of the things that scares me now. But at that time, my only feeling was relief that I'd decided to follow her. I made her work until dark one afternoon. I didn't need any excuses. We were snowed under with orders. I waited until the street door slammed, then I ran down. I was wearing rubber-soled shoes. I slipped on a dark coat she'd never seen me in, and a dark hat. I stood in the doorway until I spotted her. She was walking by Ardley Park toward the heart of town. It was one of those warm fall nights. I followed her on the other side of the street. My idea for tonight was just to find out where she lived. That would give me a hold on her. She stopped in front of a display window of Everly's department store, standing back from the glow. She stood there, looking in. I remembered we'd done a big photograph of her for Everly's, to make a flat model for a lingerie display. That was what she was looking at. At the time, it seemed all right to me that she should adore herself. if that was what she was doing. When people passed, she'd turn away a little or drift farther into the shadows. Then a man came by alone. I couldn't see his face very well, but he looked middle-aged. He stopped and stood looking in the window. She came out of the shadows and stepped up beside him. How would you boys feel if you were looking at a poster of the girl, and suddenly she was there beside you, her arm linked with yours? This fellow's reaction showed plain as day. A crazy dream had come to life for him. They talked for a moment, then he waved a taxi to the curb. They got in and drove off. I got drunk that night. It was almost as if she'd known I was following her and had picked that way to hurt me. Maybe she had. Maybe this was the finish. But the next morning she turned up at the usual time, and I was back in the delirium, only now with some new angles added. That night, when I followed her, she picked a spot under a street lamp, opposite one of the Munch Girl billboards. Now it frightens me to think of her lurking that way. After about 20 minutes, a convertible slowed down going past her, backed up, swung into the curb. I was closer this time. I got a good look at the fellow's face. He was a little younger, about my age. Next morning, the same face looked up at me from the front page of the paper. The convertible had been found parked on a side street. He had been in it. As in the other maybe murders, the cause of death was uncertain. All kinds of thoughts were spinning in my head that day, but there were only two things I knew for sure: that I'd got the first real offer from a national advertiser, and that I was going to take the girl's arm and walk down the stairs with her when we quit work. She didn't seem surprised. "You know what you're doing?" she said. "I know." She smiled. "I was wondering when you'd get around to it." I began to feel good. I was kissing everything goodbye, but I had my arm around hers. It was another of those warm fall evenings. We cut across into Ardley Park. It was dark there, but all around the sky was a sallow pink from the advertising signs. We walked for a long time in the park. She didn't say anything, and she didn't look at me, but I could see her lips twitching, and after a while her hand tightened on my arm. We stopped. We'd been walking across the grass. She dropped down and pulled me after her. She put her hands on my shoulders. I was looking down at her face. It was the faintest sallow pink from the glow in the sky. The hungry eyes were dark smudges. I was fumbling with her blouse. She took my hand away, not like she had in the studio. "I don't want that," she said. "First, I'll tell you what I did afterward. Then I'll tell you why I did it. Then I'll tell you what she said. What I did was run away. I don't remember all of that because I was dizzy and the pink sky was swinging against the dark trees, but after a while, I staggered into the lights of the street. The next day, I closed up the studio. The telephone was ringing when I locked the door, and there were unopened letters on the floor. I never saw the girl again in the flesh, if that's the right word. I did it because I didn't want to die. I didn't want the life drawn out of me. There are vampires and vampires, and the ones that suck blood aren't the worst. If it hadn't been for the warning of those dizzy flashes and Papa Munch and the face in the morning paper, I'd have gone the way the others did. But I realized what I was up against while there was still time to tear myself away. I realized that wherever she came from, whatever shaped her, she's the quintessence of the horror behind the bright billboard. She's the smile that tricks you into throwing away your money and your life. She's the eyes that lead you on, and then show you death. She's the creature you give everything for and never really get. She's the being that takes everything you've got and gives nothing in return. When you yearn toward her face on the billboards, remember that. She's the lure. She's the bait. She's the girl. And this is what she said.
I want you. I want your high spots. I want everything that's made you happy and everything that's hurt you bad. I want your first girl. I want that shiny bicycle. I want that licking. I want that pinhole camera. I want Betty's legs. I want the blue sky filled with stars. I want your mother's death. I want your blood on the cobblestones. I want Mildred's mouth. I want the first picture you sold. I want the lights of Chicago. I want the gin. I want Gwen's hands. I want your wanting me. I want your life. Feed me, baby. Feed me.
This is War. The Living Dead by Robert Bloch. Robert Albert Bloch, 1917 to 1994, was born in Chicago and began a successful and prolific writing career at an early age. An avid reader of the most successful pulp magazine in the science fiction and horror genres, Weird Tales, he especially liked the work of H.P. Lovecraft and began a correspondence with him. Lovecraft encouraged Bloch's writing ambitions, resulting in two stories being sold to Weird Tales at the age of 17. Bloch went on to write hundreds of short stories and 20 novels, the most famous being Psycho, 1959, which was memorably filmed by Alfred Hitchcock. While his early work was virtually a pastiche of Lovecraft, he went on to develop his own style. Much of his work was exceptionally dark, gory, and violent for its time, but a plethora of his short fiction has elements of humor, often relying on a pun or wordplay in the last line. A famously warm, friendly, and humorous man in real life, he defended himself against charges of being a macabre writer by saying that he wasn't that way at all. "Why, I have the heart of a small boy," he said. "It's in a jar, on my desk." He commonly created a short story by inventing a good pun for the last line, then writing a story to accompany it. The Living Dead was first published in the April 1967 issue of Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. It was first published in book form in The King of Terrors, New York, Mysterious Press, 1977.
The Living Dead by Robert Bloch. Read by Robertson Dean. All day long he rested, while the guns thundered in the village below. Then, in the slanting shadows of the late afternoon, the rumbling echoes faded into the distance, and he knew it was over. The American advance had crossed the river. They were gone at last, and it was safe once more. Above the village, in the crumbling ruins of the great chateau atop the wooded hillside, Count Barsac emerged from the crypt. The Count was tall and thin, cadaverously thin, in a manner most hideously appropriate. His face and hands had a waxen pallor. His hair was dark, but not as dark as his eyes and the hollows beneath them. His cloak was black, and the sole touch of color about his person was the vivid redness of his lips when they curled in a smile. He was smiling now, in the twilight, for it was time to play the game. The name of the game was Death, and the Count had played it many times. He had played it in Paris, on the stage of the Grand Guignol. His name had been plain Eric Caron then, but still he'd won a certain renown for his interpretation of bizarre roles. Then the war had come, and, with it, his opportunity. Long before the Germans took Paris, he'd joined their underground, working long and well. As an actor, he'd been invaluable. And this, of course, was his ultimate reward, to play the supreme role, not on the stage, but in real life. To play without the artifice of spotlights, in true darkness. This was the actor's dream come true. He had even helped to fashion the plot. Simplicity itself, he told his German superiors. Chateau Barsac has been deserted since the revolution. None of the peasants from the village dare to venture near it, even in daylight, because of the legend. It is said, you see, that the last Count Barsac was a vampire. And so it was arranged.